Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Today we begin the show by talking about a very unusual weather event in the boundary waters of northern Minnesota in the Superior National Forest. And our guest is Kerry Griffith. His latest book is Gunflint Falling, Blowdown in the Boundary Waters. Maybe you remember that storm that flattened trees over, I think, a nearly 500,000-acre area. What questions do you have about it, how it happened, or how the cleanup was conducted? Maybe you were there. It's possible, for sure. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Kerry Griffith, good to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Larry, for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, it seems like when you are on, we're talking about disasters as they relate to the Gunflint area, Gunflint Burning. It was a fantastic book, and the same is true of Gunflint Falling, Blowdown in the Boundary Waters. You know, I'm sure that probably a largest percentage of our listeners have heard of the Boundary Waters, and you have a sort of a vague idea about it. Maybe it would be good to start by just telling us a bit about the Boundary Waters.
Oh, sure. It's a million-acre wilderness in northeastern Minnesota. It's part of the Superior National Forest. The Superior National Forest is actually 3 million acres, I think. The Boundary Waters sits in the center of it. Big wilderness area. I'm sure lots of your listeners have been there. You know, it's as beautiful as northern Wisconsin is, too. Lakes and waters, riverways, gorgeous area, boreal forest, just beautiful.
It absolutely is, and with great opportunities for people to visit and participate.
Yeah, definitely. I think it gets a fair amount of traffic, especially during the summer, not so much in the winter, although people do go in and winter camp and spend some time in the Boundary Waters during the winter. But in the summer, yeah, it is it's one of our most heavily used wilderness areas. And by wilderness, I mean, you know, that it's an area where there are no roads, there's no signage, you know, you can take in maps. The only way you can get around is, in almost all of it, is by canoe. So it's primitive, and they've kind of kept it primitive. In fact, even when they repair portages or work on campsites, that kind of thing, they do so with primitive tools. So it's a definite wilderness area, but it definitely gets heavy usage.
Yeah, absolutely. Only hand tools. You're not going to take a chainsaw in there if you're going on a trip.
No.
Hand saws and axes, and that's kind of about it. Well, let's take a look at that storm. Describe the kind of storm that hit that area. And this is, you know, a busy time there, July 4th, but it was 1999.
Yes, Larry, it was 25 years ago this July. And it doesn't seem like that long ago because I still sort of remember when it happened. Although, you know, this, I have to sidetrack for a second, mention that this was really before the widespread use of cell phones. And I mean,
yes,
there were cell phones then, but not iPhones. And if it would have happened today, we would have known about it immediately because we would have seen pictures and videos and all kinds of stuff on social media. But of course, back then we didn't. But the storm that blew through on July 4th, 99, I'm sure some of your listeners probably remember. Some of them may have been in the wilderness. That was a derecho, which is a straight line wind. And it started in northwestern Minnesota. It blew through the Boundary Waters, did its most extensive damage in the Boundary Waters. But a lot of people don't know this about that storm, but it actually turned out to be a 6,000-mile-long windstorm that wreaked havoc across southern Canada, northeastern United States, turn south along the Atlantic seaboard, turn back inland in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, blew ultimately through the Mississippi Delta and finally burned itself out about 2 or 3 days later in the Gulf of Mexico. So it was a significant windstorm.
You know, we do a weather show the last Monday of every month, and I know I've got some weather listeners here. What kind of meteorological events led to that storm?
Well, it was really unexpected. I've read today meteorologists would have a better sense that something like that was developing. The nearest they could tell, the weather center in Norman, Oklahoma, for the National Weather Service, you know, there's a National Weather Service regional station in Grand Forks that's responsible for northwestern Minnesota, and Duluth, that's responsible for northeastern Minnesota. And their forecasts didn't really mention anything about terrible weather. I mean, they didn't really know. Now, Norman, Oklahoma saw some storms coming up out of Montana and South Dakota about 24 hours preceding that. But they thought that these storms would kind of fizzle out before they hit northwestern Minnesota. And then early in the morning, about 7:30, just west of Fargo, the character of those storms, this is a phrase the Weather Service used in analyzing it afterwards, abruptly changed. And it turned into this really devastating windstorm that did a lot of damage in Fargo, kept blowing east, northeast, damaged Bemidji on its way into the Boundary Waters.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And for your book, I want to just compliment you on the book. It's really well done and gives a lot of accounts, including, you know, first-person accounts by those who were in there. But you had to, and then, of course, all of the people who helped, you know, with the fixing things, you know, if you could call it that, after the storm blew through. You had a lot of first-person accounts and were able to talk to many people about this.
Yeah, I did. And yeah, thanks for those kind remarks regarding the book. I really appreciate it. Yeah, I think I probably spoke with more than 100 people. You know, I call out, I think, 60 in the acknowledgments. And I owe a huge debt of gratitude to those folks. Without, you know, of course, not all of them appear in the book. I tried to limit it to a certain number of key stories that conveyed the intensity of the storm. But without their, you know, generous time and gracious sharing of their stories and stuff, this book wouldn't have been possible. So I owe a huge debt of gratitude to those folks.
Well, and here it was July 4th, and a lot of people were in and it was really even hard to determine how many were there.
Yeah, it really was. Now, this was back in 99, so the wilderness permitting process was a little bit different. So, you know, the estimates, the best estimates by the people at the time were there were 4,000 to 10,000 people in the wilderness at that time. But they didn't, you know, they didn't have a real good sense of it. And, it was kind of tough at that time to track people. And there were two schools of thought about people in the wilderness. Over the 4th of July holiday, some people, officials, thought, well, the forest would be, the wilderness would be full of people taking advantage of the holiday. And then there were others, there was another school of thought that figured most people spend their time on, you know, they spend their time at home over the 4th of July holiday, you know, attending parades and whatnot. But between the two, yeah, there were quite a few people in it. It's a big wilderness, 1 million acres, so it can easily handle 4,000 to 10,000 people.
Yeah, absolutely. So the you're in the Boundary Waters. What did the area look like maybe let's just switch to afterwards for a minute here. What did the area look like after the storm blew through?
Well, it was from the pictures I've seen, and certainly the eyewitness accounts from people I've spoken with, that wilderness was devastated. I mean, there's, as I mentioned earlier, it was a big storm, 6,000 miles long, kept blowing. But it really did most of its intense damage right in the boundary waters. And it, in the boundary waters, it felled about 48 million trees. So, and some of these trees were huge, you know, 40 inches in diameter, big old growth, 200-year-old pines. And the pictures that you see of it in the aftermath, as they flew over and began to realize what had happened, were just incredible. I mean, almost every tree for about a 5 to 10 mile swath and 30 miles long was laying down in the direction from west to east. They just fell that way because that's the way the storm blew. And it was just really incredible. Probably the most remarkable thing that I discovered was there were no fatalities. There were a lot of
That was almost incomprehensible to me.
Oh, it was too to me, Larry. I mean, I couldn't. In fact, you know, when I interviewed the Forest Service people that were part of the search and rescue and recovery, for about the first 7 to 10 days, they had a very detailed instructions that they give people every time they're headed out to do search and recovery, search and rescue and recovery. And those details were what you should do when you find a body, not if, when. You know, mark it off, call the sheriff's office, the sheriff investigates deaths. They had this whole plan that fortunately they never had to implement.
Yeah, it absolutely astounding to me. And I'll just as an aside, I have some property in with some friends in northern Wisconsin in the Barnes area. And on July 31st of that same year, we had a similar incident in that area at the Shawamigan National Forest, about 100,000 acres. Were affected, and it was right through a hunting area where I hunt. And so walking through that in the fall several months later, I thought to myself, how could anyone have survived if they were caught out in this? These huge trees taken down, and then these huge root balls that were maybe 10 feet tall in some cases. It was just astounding to me, and I can't. And it had to have been 10 times as bad, or just as bad at least in the boundary waters.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, I think I've heard a few people tell me about that event, and that affected about 100,000 acres. But you know, the blowdown affected about 500,000 acres. And it is amazing. I mean, you know, as the storm continued blowing east, northeast, there were some other casualties in Maine and southern Canada that the storm affected. But yeah, it is just remarkable that there were no fatalities. As I mentioned in the book, of course, I cover some people. There were definitely injured people,
sure,
quite a few, but no one died.
Yeah, and we'll talk about some of those injured parties as we move along here today. Kerry Griffith, our guest today, his latest book, it's a dandy, it's titled Gunflint Falling, Blowdown in the Boundary Waters. You can join in. Hope you have a question or an experience to share. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Tyler Dinner, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. By the way, we are taking a big risk here at WPR. We're shrinking our winter member drive from 7 days to just one. And why? Well, because we know you value the programs you listen to every day, and we want to minimize the disruptions to your listening experience. But we can only pull this off with your help. So if you haven't given yet, give now at WPR.org/donate. That's WPR.org/donate. We're talking today with Kerry Griffith about his latest book. It's Gunflint Falling, Blowdown in the Boundary Waters. Again, questions, comments, experiences to share. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Kerry, I was interested in what people had to say as the storm approached, and maybe you can kind of summarize what was going through the minds of some people.
Yeah, you know, as I mentioned earlier, people that were in the boundary waters, of course, several of them that I track in the book were not, they were in the boundary waters on the first or the second, you know, well ahead of the storm. And so they, in the boundary waters, especially back in 99, they had no way to get weather forecasts or any other breaking news or anything like that. And so the only thing they could do was look at the sky and, you know, sense the weather as it was beginning to change around them. And that particular morning, dawn, really hot, really stifling, incredibly still. The lakes were just like polished steel. And it started to change about 11:15, 11:30 as it moved into the area. And then I've heard different shades of color from yeah. a variety of people there. Some of the people said most of them said the skies to the west turned green, kind yeah. of a green, ugly green, but some said purple. You know, some said it was more of an amber hue, but regardless, you know, they could tell something really significant was on its way.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it went through. And you mentioned the rescue workers. And it's an interesting thing when a storm of this magnitude hits. The organization is usually there's different government agencies involved, but somebody has to sort of make the decision how many resources are we going to have to put into this, and then how do we organize all the different parties involved?
Yeah, exactly. There's an incident command system, a hierarchy that's involved with big forest fires like the Ham Lake fire I write about in Gunflint Burning, and or this event, this blowdown event that I write about in this book. And there's five tiers to that, and the lowest level tier is a incident command grade five, I guess you'd call it. And it goes all the way up to grade one, which is a national effort that draws on national resources. Well, the blowdown became a type two event. So it was managed with a type two team right in Minnesota. And actually it drew from Wisconsin resources too. But it was a type two headquartered out of Ely, Minnesota. And yes, you're absolutely right, Larry. They organized everything as best they could. You know, they sent people in. They were the key people that sort of resourced and managed the first 2 weeks after the blowdown happened.
Yeah, and there were just a lot of things. And, of course, the first priority of a type two is get out there and search for people.
Exactly. Yep.
And
search and rescue.
Search and rescue. And it was interesting to me that even disagreements can come up even on flight patterns when they're should we fly in a grid kind of situation, because you've got a lot of planes up there flying around, or should we just hit the lakes where most people, you know, the around the lakes where most people were?
Yeah, exactly. I kind of talk about that a little bit in the book, because the guy that was in charge of the Civil Air Patrol got involved in the search and rescue, and just sort of mapping out the area to see if they could find any survivors or anybody that needed help. And that guy wasn't as familiar with the boundary waters as some of the Forest Service beaver pilots and some of the other Forest Service people up there. And he wanted to do that sort of standard grid search that the Civil Air Patrol does in instances like this. And they did do it. They did it very quickly, but then they didn't really find anything, and or they may have found one or two, but nothing like that were actually out there. So then they subsequently went back, and the Forest Service perspective prevailed, and they did more of a campsite, portage, lake search, and then they found more people.
Yeah, they found more. Maybe we could talk about the experience. Let's see. Let me pick Ray and Michelle, or you, Lisa Hunt. I think there were a couple of other people involved in that group. Just talk about their experience. Why were they in the area and so forth?
Sure. Yeah, it was the Oreos, the Schwendingers, and they went in with a friend, Lisa Nass. There were five of them. And, you know, they were doing what many of us do during a holiday. They were recently new into the workforce. They were, you know, didn't have a lot of vacation time, so they were taking advantage of a long holiday weekend. And Ray and Michelle first went in because they knew Ray, who had been up in Lake Polly, which is sort of the south central boundary waters area. He knew of a campsite that he wanted to, you know, use. It was about four or five portages in, probably took about 4 hours to get in there. And he thought that would be perfect for his group. Lisa Nass, this was only her second time in the boundary waters. The Schwendingers, they had been in a little bit more, but they were all friends. And, sure enough, Ray and Michelle went in. I think they camped on the outskirts of the boundary waters the first, and went in the second, scored the campsite, and then, you know, were followed in on the third, Saturday the third, in 99, July 4th was a Sunday. On Saturday the 3rd, they all got together, had a great time, you know, brought in some boxed wine and, you know, and they were close enough. And they were only going to, the plan was they were only going to spend all day the 4th, well, the evening of the 3rd, all day the 4th, and then they were going to paddle out the 5th and head home. But of course, you know, that morning of the 4th broke, and it was just hot and still, as I mentioned before. And, you know, most of them all went swimming to kind of beat the heat and just hung out in the water. And sure enough, about 11:30, this storm, the weather begins to change. They actually have a campsite that they can see to the west. It looks out over the lake. So they see these ugly storms coming, and they see the wall of water, rainfall coming as it crosses the lake. Things start blowing, and Lisa, who was in solo, had rented a lightweight Kevlar canoe from Sawbill Outfitters over off Highway 61 over there. And when she looked out at the height of the storm, they were kind of huddled behind a tarp. When she looked out at the height, she saw the wind was so intense it was starting to lift up her canoe, and she was worried the canoe would get blown away, and so she ran down to secure it, and just as she got to her canoe, she was struck by a falling tree and grazed her head, and if it had been over another 2 inches and struck her on the head, it would have crushed her skull. But as it was, she was hurt pretty bad.
Yeah. And the rest of them, I think, didn't they lay out in the open a little bit? They realized the trees coming down, you don't want to be sitting under one of those trees.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah, they did. And they were, you know, they were out in the middle of the, in the open, and it was still raining. But yeah, they were worried about the fallen trees. And so they thought that was probably the safest place at that point.
Yeah. And of course they needed to get to her and get her comforted or whatever, and then try to get her out after the fact.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they knew just from how hurt she was in and out of consciousness. There was just no way they could portage out with her. There was no way they could go through those four portages or so that they had taken to get here. So, yeah, that her friends, this was one of the things I was struck with in the book and the people I interviewed, you know, everyday, ordinary people doing heroic things. And that's what the Schwendigers did. They took a couple bottles of water, a couple of candy bars, and they went as fast as they possibly could out those same portages, did it in less than half the time it took to get in, and were able to call out for help because, they called the Forest Service and let them know that there was a person here on Lake Polly that needed to be airlifted out.
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing. The other one I was thinking about was Vicki Brockman. I think it was Vicki Brockman.
Yeah, Vicki Brockman. Yep.
Brockman.
Yep. You know, the funny thing about her story was Vicki was hurt. She was hurt pretty bad. Very similar to Lisa Nass in that there was no way a tree fell on her. She was kind of in a fetal position when the storm blew through and she could hear trees falling. She was worried. She turned on her side, covered her head with her arms, and sure enough, a tree fell right on her hip and cracked her pelvis. And there was just no way she could move, really, after that. There was no way she was going to get out. And so, you know, her friends, she was in a more populous place than Lake Polly. She was on Alpine Lake, which is right next to Seagull Lake, which is near the end of the Gunflint Trail. And she was able to tell people that were trying to get out of the woods because they were all blown down around them. She told, you know, people, tell them to send help, tell them to medevac in. And sure enough, yeah, by the evening, both Lisa and Vicki end up getting medevaced out to Ely, Minnesota, to the hospital there.
And even that process of getting her medevaced out was in itself a real travail, let's put it that way, because they were down trees and you're trying to get somebody on a litter, and who's injured out. Man, it was, I'm telling you. The number to call, by the way, is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Jim in Mauston, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, listening to your story this morning, actually, I'd taken my son and a group of his friends up right after they graduated in 99, and we were just coming off the Boundary Waters when that storm hit, and a couple of canoe groups were going in as we were coming out, and it looked like they were rookies, so a couple of us just shook our heads and kind of wished them good luck. But on the way out on Highway 2, it seemed like everybody who owns a pickup or everybody who lives up there has a chainsaw in their truck. And so those people went along and cut trees off of Highway 2, and we helped move them to the side of the road. And we found it was pretty cool. But, we were sitting in Ely there when the storm actually went through.
Oh, yeah. And you know, Jim there is with a group, and you do talk about a group of, might have been scouts. I can't remember, Carrie, in the book.
Oh, yeah. There was a group of scouts. Actually, it was Pat Lowe was on his way out. If I remember correctly, he was out on his way out with Vicki Brockman. And he got. It was his last flight of the day. There was just enough light left. he went over a lake, or somehow he got word that some people were down, some scouts and stuff were down in a nearby lake that was sort of on his way back to Ely. It was starting to get dark, and sure enough, he put down and he came out with a scout leader and a scout who had broken his collarbone, and they got in the plane with Vicky and, you know, the others headed out. And
yeah.
Jim, you know, Jim was in Ely. Ely, you know, the funny thing about this storm is Ely was hit, and the parade, which was scheduled for 1 o'clock, was postponed until about 2 o'clock. But by then, you know, they only had a few down trees and a little hail damage. But other than that, it wasn't too much. It wasn't until it got about 5 to 10 miles east of Ely that it really put down and stayed down and did all the damage.
It's interesting. By the way, we'll be talking with Jenny Nelson, who's the owner and manager of Spirit of the Wilderness Outfitters, and they're located in Ely, if I'm not mistaken. So that'll be coming up in a few minutes. But the Michael emailed to say natural disturbances occur regularly in forests. What's the frequency of these windstorms in boreal forests? How many intervening years occur with these large scale storms?
Well, I can, from interviewing something like Lee Frelick, the forestry professor at the University of Minnesota, and some others, I've read where their frequency in boreal forests, corporeal forests are further north, are increasing. I don't know specifically how often they happen, but pretty much I think we're seeing an increased frequency of these derecho storms. But more importantly, one of the big things about this storm is that rarely do storms of that magnitude happen at that latitude. Now, that may differ as more climate change takes hold and the forests are beginning to change the further north you get, and the weather patterns are starting to change a little bit. But it was very unusual for a storm like that to hit the boundary waters in the way it did. And I don't think I did find one or two references to blowdowns. And then there are these things called, they're just spot blowdowns, basically. They're technically not derechos. A derecho has to be 250 miles long or longer. But they're downbursts. Downbursts will occasionally do damage to the forest in different places and has over the years, but nothing like this derecho that was very unusual. And I don't think there's been anything quite like it, but they do expect that there may be in the future.
Yeah, I was really intrigued by the interview, the researcher talking in the book about how climate change could, I mean, over a long period of time, actually eliminate the boreal forest if the conditions of derechos, for example, started happening in 5-year or 10-year increments instead of 20 or more years.
Yeah, that was Lee. He suggests that if the temperatures keep rising, the forests that are now the boreal forests in northeastern Minnesota, probably northern Wisconsin too, I suspect, will more resemble oak savannas, the kind that you have down in southern Minnesota and southern Wisconsin.
Yeah, really interesting. And, you know, you wrote about the Gunflint Fire, which occurred before this.
Well, actually, no, fire...
Well, it was after...
Yeah, the Ham Lake Fire of 2007 is what I write about in Gunflint Burning. I kind of look at this book, the Blowdown book, as the prequel to that because it happened before. And all the fuel that was left over from the blowdown was one of the reasons the Ham Lake Fire burned so hot and intense.
Yeah. So in your mind, what is the area, you know, we'll be talking with our outfitter in just a few minutes. In your mind, what does the area look like now?
Well, you know, I've got to tell you, Larry, I'm really shocked when I go up there. You know, I went up right after the forest fire. Coincidentally, my wife and I were up there. We were driving down the Gunflint Trail. Still, some of the woods were smoldering when we went through. And I was just, I felt devastated for the people up there, for the forest. It looked terrible. And you go up there now. And it is, the forest is pretty resilient. I mean, it's beautiful. It's green. It's, you know, it's really sprung back. And, you know, you begin to learn that forest fires, at least, are important for the ecology of a boreal forest. And similar to the blowdown, you know, there's still fuel in the forest from that blowdown. But, you know, it's been 25 years ago, so a lot of it has been rotted. Much of it has been burned. They're still doing, the Forest Service does prescribed burns to try to get rid of some of it. But yeah, I mean, I'm just kind of blown away. You can go up there. The forest has changed. The forest definitely looks different, definitely lost a lot of old growth, but it's still, you know, quite beautiful.
Beautiful, absolutely. And Frank had wondered in a call, couldn't stay with us, what was done with all the trees that were blown down. And outside the immediate area where there was damage, that wood was turned into useful material, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it was. I mean, where they could get to it, it was. But of course, we're talking in the Boundary Waters, we're talking about a wilderness area. No roads,
yeah.
No real way to get in there. And, you know, a lot of people have asked, why didn't they go in and harvest all that stuff? And I did an appearance recently with Jim Sanders, who was the Forest Service supervisor at the time, the head of the Forest Service at the time. And he was explaining to some people in the audience that, you know, those fallen trees, they fell in such a way that a lot of them were broken off at the top. And the wood just, it doesn't take long for wood to go bad. It looks like it's okay to you and I, but if it's anywhere from 6 to 18 months after, it's not harvestable. It's not even useful as pulp. And, you know, to get into the Boundary Waters and harvest that stuff, they would have had to put in roads, and it would have taken 6 or 18 months to put in roads. So it wasn't an easy thing to do in the Boundary Waters. They were just kind of stuck, actually.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, this is a fascinating story, and I'm really glad you took the time and energy to write the Gunflint Falling story, Carrie.
Thanks, Larry.
It's a wonderful book, and let us know when your next book's coming out.
I'll do that. Thanks a lot.
Carrie Griffith, his latest book is Gunflint Falling, Blowdown in the Boundary Waters. Really worth your read, I'll tell you that. Coming up, we're going to stay in the Boundary Waters, but talk about what you need for a trip to the Boundary Waters. And we've got an expert, Ginny Nelson, to help us out. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.